Hi, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind everyone, this is our Rethink the Week, which means you will be hearing it on Monday. But of course, we're going to be Zooming it on Sunday night. As you've come to expect, we begin every show we have for months with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I can't get bored telling you about this because he was a patriot, because it was about love of country, because he was outraged by what he saw, and he realized that he needed to do this because it was more important than him. And as he assured his father that it would be okay, most of us knew it probably was not. And as you know, he has now left the service because of the kind of harassment that he could no longer withstand. So now the impeachment hearing of 2019 and the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I can't believe it's only been a week. Actually, in the last 48 hours, we've probably covered more material than in an entire week, but that's life with Donald Trump. So this is our Rethink the Week. I'm going to introduce two of our regular guests, and then I will introduce one of our new panelists. We have Val Endres. She is a professor at Rhode Island College. Her area of expertise is political communication, and I have had the honor and privilege not only of having her on the radio with me, but going down to Rhode Island College and hanging out with her students. So thank you so much for joining us, Val.
Yes, thank you, Arnie, and you're a big fan favorite in Rhode Island.
Well, I love them too. And joining us from Southern New Hampshire University, only he's not there quite now because they're going to be doing everything online, is Dean Spiliotis. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio's sort of end of the week wrap up, and he has a political blog entitled nhpoliticalcapital.com. Welcome back, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
And last but clearly not least is Dr. Matt Nelson, a new PhD from Northwestern University. I just need to let everyone know, we were Zooming with him the day before he was defending his dissertation. So the day that he was on the air, he was defending his dissertation. And as you notice, I refer to him as Dr. Matthew Nelson. So welcome to the program, Matt. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me back.
And someone asked, so what is your area of expertise? And it's race, ethnicity, politics, political behavior, youth political engagement, civic education, political socialization, urban politics. Boy, you must have been sensing the moment. I mean, you are the perfect political scientist at this moment in time. So I'm really glad to have you. There's so much I want to talk about, but because we're all in this sort of moment about whether, you know, who's Joe Biden going to pick as his VP, the kind of harassment women still get because, you know, are they ready for the job? You know, what happens when they have their menstrual cycle? I mean, all these ridiculous things are happening. You know, will they be able to sort of cope with the pressures of being president of the United States? I do need to let you know that I went to the Christian Science Monitor literally minutes before this show. And I don't know whether any of you have been following the election today in Belarus. Anyone been following it? Probably not. Well, let me enlighten you because she is my new hero. Here is the title of the piece: An Election with Bravery on the Ballot. Belarus's dictator has let a housewife run against him. She's popping a bubble of fear among voters. Just let me read you a couple of sentences. She sounds like hot stuff. One early sign of a dictator's eventual demise is the moment when people cast off fear of his retribution against opponents. for Belarus, a small ex-Soviet nation next to Russia. That moment may come August 9th, today, everyone, in an election that could be largely rigged to favor its longtime ruler. For some reason, President Alexander Lukashenko has allowed a candidate that he dismisses as just a housewife to run against him. Perhaps he needs a sheen of democracy, or actually believes his statement that Belarus has not matured enough for a woman to become president. Little did he anticipate that Svetlana, I'm going to butcher her last name, Tikhanovskaya, a former English teacher and translator, would draw big crowds with this campaign pitch. Ready? Now is the time when everyone must overcome their fear. And then the rest of the story is about the harassment, her husband being arrested. I mean, if anyone understands fear, it's this candidate. But that the campaign following people are, she's inspiring them. It's just, it's like, I read it and I almost had goosebumps. And what she says is at the end, if she wins, Svetlana says her goal will be to quickly hold a legitimate election within 6 months, one in which freed political prisoners could run and people do not succumb to fear of retribution. She's already set an example of that. So I think she's like a palate cleanser. We need to know that there's people like this. We need to know that sort of these kinds of folks can dream the dream, and we will see what happens in Belarus, but I wanted to sort of start there. But Val, I'm gonna start with you. We're the two girls on the panel. And we're talking about Joe Biden's pick for VP. And there have been lots of things that we've been hearing about them, the typical sort of things that you hear rolled out whenever you hear a woman candidate. She's too shrill. She's too aggressive. Just incredible things, including things like, you know, what happens during that time of the month? How will she behave? I mean, I can't believe it's 2020 and we're still talking about menstrual cycles. But it's just, the package is just incredible. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out is that have we actually moved beyond it? Or is one of the reasons why we're sort of slipping back into this sort of gender, I don't know, silo, is because Donald Trump has really sort of brought back everything from the 1950s. And someone even said that, you know, they're even questioning what's Donald Trump's gender, which I thought was such an interesting question to ask. And I'm not sure I know the answer to it either. So I'm kind of curious, how are you reacting to this? And are you exhausted by it, or do we just need to elect a woman as VP or elect a woman as president, and then we can get over it?
Well, I don't think we'll get over it with a VP and a president, but I think that is tremendously important for future generations. I think part of this has to do with, on one side, the politics of resentment and fear, and they fear nearly everything that isn't white or male. And part of this, I think, is, and I'm part of the baby boomer generation, but it's the last gasp of power from men in the baby boomer generation that really resent seeing new people enter the political arena or the power arenas in corporations. And you know what we see in politics also happens inside the corporation. Women CEOs, the numbers have not increased substantially since the 1950s. Again, have not increased substantially since the 1950s. And when they get to a top position, often they're placed in that position during economic vulnerable times so that they can easily be fired and replaced. But I think though, the good news is with a younger generation, just as we saw with issues, for example, gay marriage, issues of gender will fade away more than they have in the past. But when we see the vetting of the vice presidents right now, we hear those same old tropes come up again, that and especially with Black women, that they're angry, they're too ambitious. And that's essentially saying that they need to be put in their place. So it's a racist, sexist trope that's being used out of fear.
So Matt, let me just tell you something. I know Chris Dodd. I'm going to give Chris Dodd a knuckle sandwich. when Chris look, I have run for office. I've been tough. I've used my elbows. I've criticized. I've chopped. I've done all these things. For him to actually say stuff that he said about Kamala Harris because of what happened during one of those early debates with Joe Biden, and that therefore she is not going to be someone that he can trust, that therefore she was too aggressive. I am looking at that going, gag me, Chris Dodd. I almost wish, here's what I wish people had done that. I wish they had gone into some of his competitive races and pulled out some of the stuff and said, really? And what did you say about this candidate? And what did you say about that candidate? But it's so interesting that somehow being sharp and tough and looking at a record and pulling it out, that somehow shows an issue of a problem of relationship or an ability to work with someone. Frankly, that's exactly the person I would want on my team, Matt.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's certainly a double standard going on here in terms of how each of these candidates is being discussed. And I think it's potentially undermining, you know, arguably a more important conversation about, you know, which of these candidates is really going to hold sway over different demographics of voters. And we mentioned young voters especially, and I think there's this sense that just by virtue of the fact that Biden is selecting a woman vice presidential candidate, that it's naturally going to mobilize younger voters who want to see this sort of representation within the Democratic Party. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that, you know, Democrats, young people, Black Americans are not homogenous populations of people. And despite what, you know, Joe Biden said earlier this week about Black Americans being, you know, a homogenous political group, there's also something to be said about, you know, Kamala Harris does have a bit of a tenuous relationship with a lot of African Americans. At the same time, someone like Elizabeth Warren is someone who gained the endorsements from a lot of young women of color, a lot of young activists. So I do think that, you know, this double standard in terms of how we're talking about each of these candidates is really getting in the way of potentially a more important conversation about, you know, what does this VP candidate represent ideologically, and how might that be an asset to Biden as he tries to mobilize young voters and marginalized communities in this
Except, Dean, what I want to say here is are two things. One is that they're not just talking about this candidate as a VP. They're talking about a replacement in 2024. I mean, I've never heard 2024 mentioned more than 2020. And that's exactly what's going on, Dean. So in a lot of ways, I feel like, oh my God, am I putting on Joe Biden the expectation that his VP is now going to sort of usurp my choice in 2024, because we have now laid a foundation for where we're going to go with the next Democratic candidate. And given the fact that Joe Biden has been, how shall I say, not exactly the most enthusiastic candidate I've ever supported. It bothers me that we're giving him so much, not just responsibility, but an ability to dictate what the future of the Democratic Party is, when I think he's been sort of out of touch with the Democratic Party as it's been changing demographically, as it's been changing politically. You know, he still insisted he would veto a Medicare for all, as now virtually everyone I know is like, I don't ever want to have to worry about whether I have health insurance. I don't ever want to have to worry about it again. I don't know what his plan is, but right now there aren't a lot of options if you don't look at something that's much more universal than everything that he seems to be embracing. And saying that, Dean, the other thing I also want to comment on is not only is this VP pick kind of frightening in a lot of ways, but then we're looking at the opening of the Democratic Convention. And my understanding is they already have their three big gets for day one. And the three big gets are kind of interesting. I call them the three faces of Eve. And they are Michelle Obama, Bernie Sanders, and bum-ba-dum-bum, Governor Kasich. So I'm like, oh, that's an interesting mixture. So you can go anywhere with this conversation. But again, it just sort of, this seems to be so much more than just about which female is he going to pick for VP. It seems to be sort of immersed in so many other issues that are far beyond which one of the women are going to be chosen.
Yeah, you know, just there's a lot to unpack there, but just real briefly on the convention, having Michelle Obama, Bernie Sanders, and John Kasich, who's been a strong critic of Donald Trump for a long, long time, you know, that's an attempt to put together as broad a coalition as possible going into the November election, get as many different types of voters who are dissatisfied with Donald Trump for one election to all band together and vote to knock Trump out of office. I mean, you know, we've talked about this VP stuff before. My general belief on this is that we spend way too much time obsessing over who the VP pick is going to be. You know, typically it ends up being a story, maybe with the exception of Sarah Palin, it ends up being a story for, you know, a week maybe. But what amazes me is all this talk about, you know, you were just talking about, you know, somebody deciding who's going to run the party in 2024. You know, the reality is virtually all vice presidents run for president. So whether it's Kamala Harris or Karen Bass or someone else, whoever you want to pick, vice presidents, when they become vice president, for the most part, start thinking about running for president, right? Dan Quayle was vice president. He attempted to run for president. George Herbert Walker Bush was vice president. He became president. Al Gore was vice president. He ran for president. Now, Joe Biden was vice president, he's running for president. So this is not something unusual. I will grant you the age issue maybe makes it a little more salient than it otherwise would be. But whether Biden is in for 4 years or 8 years, whoever the sitting vice president is someone that the rest of the party is going to have to deal with. The idea that there's just going to be some placeholder because Joe Biden is old and then in 4 years or 8 years, it'll be this sort of wide open race, it's just not the case. If Biden wins, the price you pay for Biden winning is that whomever the vice president is, that person is the front runner for 2024, 2028, whatever it ends up being. And the other thing I would say is, you know, I'm amazed. I hear voters, progressives, a variety of different individuals say, well, you know, as you were saying, I'm really unexcited about Joe Biden. I need to be excited by the VP pick. This is a referendum on Donald Trump. If there's not enough to motivate you to vote now, and the VP pick is the thing that's going to determine whether or not you vote, you're misreading the entire circumstances that we find ourselves in right now.
Well, there was a professor who's picked, I'll pick you, Ken, just a second. There was a professor who's picked every single candidate correctly since 1984. He was just on. And he talked about that. He said he doesn't look at polls. He doesn't look at any other things. He kind of looks at these sort of seven triggers. And Donald Trump has failed practically, I think, every trigger. So this is definitely a referendum. And he doesn't even need to look at Biden. It could be Joe Schmo. It doesn't matter. It's just someone with a D next to his name.
Yeah.
And given what he is looking at, having looked at this historically and picked it accurately, every 4 years, there is no question in his mind that whatever shows up on the Democratic side will be to Donald Trump because Donald Trump has defeated himself. Ken?
Two things related to that. One is that I think, Dean, great point about how the vice president is always going to run for president, so we don't have to worry that Biden is now picking the president for 2024. But still, the issue to me is really not so much who's going to bring in the most votes to help Biden get elected, because I agree the vice presidential candidate isn't going to do that, but really how that person is going to govern, help Biden govern during the next 4 years. And two things. One, somebody who's competent, but also somebody who we can trust to not be venal and interested in her own self-promotion and interests, and also, in my view, fairly progressive politically.
So let me just stop you there, Ken. Can you name me a venal person we've elected as that we've chosen as vice president? Give me an example of venal. Well, I mean, I can give you an example on the Republican side. Let me think about Rumsfeld. Let me think about Cheney. Who's been venal? I mean, I hate to say this, but Democrats are kind of depressing because they're never. Those words you're using are words Republicans use about Democrats, but Democrats never deliver on the venal. I'm just
right.
I'm
okay.
Just
well,
you. Clinton may have come the closest.
Venal is way too strong a word for this, but I agree with what people are saying about the sexist ways in which people are describing women candidates. But I do think that Kamala Harris's attack on Joe Biden was really duplicitous or wrong, in part, not because it was 30 years old or whatever, but she herself did it for her own. She wanted attention, and she was the first one out of the block to not be Biden.
Ken,
media pay
Ken,
attention
two,
to.
Two words for you, Ken.
And then
two
she
words
said,
for you.
Yeah?
Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. George Herbert Walker Bush attacked Reagan mercilessly.
No,
he was the vice president.
It's not that, Dean. It's that I don't trust her. She herself, after this attack on Biden for not supporting busing as a remedy for desegregation, she herself was asked the next day the question, do you support it? And she said, no, she doesn't support it herself. Yet she's trashing Biden for being racist because he
I thought, you know, Ken, I'm with you on that. I thought it was a very poorly executed attack. I thought she was a very uneven presidential candidate. I by no means am saying that she's the one who should be chosen. All I'm saying is that whoever gets the nod, if Biden wins, whatever corner of the party is unhappy with that individual is going to have to deal with them in the next election. That's just how having exactly.
You're absolutely right. Okay, so I want to move on. So I decided, Val, that I think Donald Trump is missing a marketing opportunity. And the marketing opportunity is he hates the White House. You know, he loves to golf at Sterling. I think it is in Virginia. He loves to go down to New Jersey, Mar-a-Lago, my God, okay? So I think what he needs to do is he needs to put the White House on Airbnb. I think he might as well at least get something out of this. Fox News will be more than willing to market it for him. I mean, just think of it. Great security, very clean, lots of support staff, and they make the best chocolate cake. I mean, just imagine. But the reason, of course, I am saying this, Val, is that it's the meatloaf, the meatloaf and the chocolate cake. Don't forget the chocolate cake. But I'm out of my mind this weekend where he decides to deliver. Was he wearing his golf clothes? I think he was deciding to deliver. So as they can figure out what to do with the next stimulus, they don't know what to do with unemployment benefits. They can't come to any kind of consensus on this. I think what's interesting, Val, is I think the Republicans were ready to come to consensus on this. But he said, no. Let me do this executive order thing first. Let me be a solo performer. Let me be, you know, like I'm going to be the king, the czar. I'm going to come and answer all your problems. And on top of that, I can also use it because some of the material I'll be able to use in an ad. And I actually think that this was all because it's all garbage. It's all garbage. But it's garbage that he can use in advertising, and it's garbage that somehow creates the illusion that he's strong, you know, that where these guys can't come to any kind of consensus, he's here to deliver because they can't. And I think he gave them the orders, don't you dare solve this.
Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting opportunity. He had the opportunity to market his golf courses as he always enjoys doing. But I had much of the same suspicion there because the reality is, in order to do what he wants to do, even on payroll deduction, is an administrative nightmare that takes months to actually enact. I think it gives him the opportunity to talk about those folks on the far left who are being uncooperative. And so I think if you want to stage this out, they will reach some sort of a compromise, and it will be sold as a Republican compromise, even though Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have compromised to the tune of about $1 trillion so far. So I think you're right about that. I think he was, and it's always, he never misses the opportunity to stage some kind of an event to show his own power, you know, to bring out the Sharpie. And he knows, or at least his advisors know, that this will be challenged in court. And by the time that they get all this figured out, and we also know we've been reading about the tax deduction or the deferment of the payroll tax, it really doesn't help that many people. It's empty rhetoric in a lot of ways, just to reinforce his power to look presidential. It was a campaign stunt.
So Matt, let me just say, so I did a couple of things. I went to an article at Business Insider where they did the math for me on what the payroll tax deduction would mean between now and December. And it's probably for someone making around maybe $50,000 or $60,000, it's about $800 is what you'll get over the course of the entire time. Okay. All right. And in like one night at Trump Tower is about the same price for one person. So I want to just make sure that we understand, you know, apples and apples. But the other thing is that in a way it's a bribe. And let me tell you why. Because what he keeps saying is it's a deferment unless I get reelected. If I get reelected, you'll never have to pay it back. But if Biden gets elected, guess what? you're going to have to come back and, you know, cough up that $830 because he's going to claw it back and get his money back. So in a lot of ways, I feel like nobody understands the math. They don't even know what the FICA is. You know, I mean, it does pay for Social Security. We do have the Medicare tax. You know, a lot of people can sort of make those connections, but what Val was saying is they don't realize how complicated it is to even be able to do that. But what it really is about is I will release you from this. Biden will send you a bill. And that's really what this is about. It's not real, but it's the idea, I'll forgive you and he'll charge you.
Yeah, so I would just reiterate Val's point. To me, this strikes me as an opportunity for him to stage his own event, to, you know, really show, you know, what he presumes to be strength as the chief executive. But, you know, one thing that I'm thinking about regarding this, getting to this question of the math, I think one thing that is really easy for people to understand is in order to receive this payroll tax deferment, you actually need to be receiving a paycheck. So there's a huge portion of the population who would not even benefit from this policy. So that is questionable, and to me is low-hanging fruit for the Biden campaign to really turn this argument being espoused by Trump on its head. And another thing I'm thinking about, I think, you know, every news column throughout the country now has essentially, you know, stated that the funding stream here is extremely questionable from a legal perspective. And when I'm thinking about the election outcomes and, you know, where Trump won in 2016 versus where he would need to win in 2020 in order to get reelected, it's in the suburbs. And I have it, I'm not quite convinced that this, you know, grandstanding on this issue of I'm just going to, you know, change all of these tax policies through executive order is something that's necessarily going to fly, you know, in these contexts where Trump really needs to turn out the same amount of support that he did in 2016 in order to get reelected.
So I think here's the good news, Dean. People can't calculate how much they're going to save unless they're a gazillionaire with a tax cut. What they do know is a check. And he's not, and that's what this is about. The $600 that has disappeared is now $400. But the $400 that he's promising, 25% of it has to be paid for by the states. Well, that ain't going to happen. I mean, every state's going to say, no way, we have nothing. We don't, you know, we got butkus. So that means it's really not $400, it's $300. So in an interesting way, the people that are going to be calculating this are not the people that are going to be looking at the FICA tax. It's the people that are going to be looking at the 400 that's really going to be 300. And frankly, what we all know is that 600 is what's been paying the rent and the electric bill and the food bill and the gas bill and this bill. So you know who's going to be really hysterical about the bye-bye to the $600? It's the economy. Because it's been keeping the economy up. This is the most bizarre situation where people are so unemployed, but yet people are still able to shop and buy for the most part because of that additional $600. And what he is doing now is just financially stupid, but also it's not going to produce, I think, the results he's looking for. So before you answer that question, I see we have to go to a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back. It's our Rethink the Week panel, Dean Spiliotis, Matt Nelson, and of course, Val Endres. Stick around.
10 little questions won't take long, necessities. Count me in and help keep us from necessities. Count me in. Don't leave me out. It's time for senses.
It's time, for senses.
Count me in.
Don't leave me out.
Don't
it's time for senses.
Out. It's time for senses. It's time for senses.
Yeah. Oh. Healthcare for the kids.
Count me in.
Better spots where we live.
Count me in.
All you gotta do is sing. You can count me in.
Count me in.
Ever heard the word census? Yeah. Word ever mentioned? Uh-huh. Government, community, job training, pension. Uh-huh. A head count done of all U.S. residents. Uh-huh. White, black, brown, mixed, everybody's relevant. Oh. The census is real, ain't nothing to be scared of. Uh-huh. We need a head count so everybody can be cared for. Uh-huh. The count's not accurate, they only funding half of it. Uh-huh. Money for the neighborhoods, back to the battleships. Uh-huh. Very important, you need to get involved. Uh-huh. And this is why the hoods haven't strongly evolved. Okay. Citizen or not, uh-huh. you gotta be counted. Uh-huh. You want a better our life and everything that's around it. This is for your future and nothing to ignore. You see it in the mail, fill that form. No need to hesitate, your info is safe. Do it for community.
Welcome back to Part 2 of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week with Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, Matt Nelson, PhD, Northwestern University, and Val Endres, professor of political communications at Rhode Island College. So just before I went to the break, Dean, I agree with that professor who has picked it right since 1984. People here, you're giving me a tax cut, but people who are like, you know, under $100,000, they know that that doesn't produce anything in the way of significant cash. And frankly, they need the cash today, not like, you know, months from now. So I think a lot of what he did was interesting packaging, but a lot of what he did is just actually giving Joe Biden more material for his next ad and giving the Lincoln Project even more material for their next ad. So I just think everybody's just happy going, keep doing it. I can't wait for your next ad and your next conversation in New Jersey.
Yeah, you know, I've spent a good chunk of the weekend listening to all of the various key players in this negotiation over the next round of financial support to come out of the government. And it's just a colossal, confusing mess. And I've listened to every major player, Steve Mnuchin, Secretary of Treasury, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell, everybody. And I think for the average person, the entire thing is occurring in a black box. This is completely opaque. It's just for competing agendas. In the end, what's going to matter is people know whether or not they're suffering. People know whether or not they're going to be evicted, whether or not they can put food on their table. We can look at the lines at food pantries and other types of organizations that are providing food and other services. And you simply know whether or not the situation is improving. I mean, there's a little bit of an uptick in job creation recently, but there's still a long way to go. Again, the lurking behind all of this is the specter of the pandemic. And as we've discussed many times before in the show, that really is what drives economic behavior, consumer confidence, and all the other things we need to get the economy going. So I have no idea. I mean, maybe they're going to cut a deal. I have no idea what they're going to decide at this point. And I imagine for the average person, understanding what they might get or when they might get it, everyone's just kind of throwing their hands up in the air.
So Val, there's like two things I keep thinking about. One is an interesting headline I saw this morning. And the headline was rise in COVID-19 cases. And Fauci is like out of his mind. He's worried about Detroit. He's worried about Boston. He's just saying this is not good. And this is before kids come back to school, where we might start seeing it even spike even more because they may be super spreader events. And then it might get even worse because it'll be the fall. And then we add the second wave of COVID. Of course, we haven't gotten out of the first wave. So we're in this incredible cycle of spiraling COVID-19. The thing that he also mentioned was, but we're seeing a decrease in the unemployment numbers. So people are going back to work whether they should or not. People are going back to work because they have to go back to work. But people are going back to work in some of the most unsafe situations because we're not mandating masks, because we're not dealing with some of the issues. And I'm looking at the South Dakota pictures in the background as I'm talking, going, where's my Harley? But it's this is what is so crazy is that we're not going back to work or back to school with dropping numbers. We're going back to work and back to school with rising numbers and not the kind of testing and not the kind of healthcare system that we need. And that's a prescription for beyond failure. That's what's so scary about this, is what this will ultimately lead to. And, you know, I'm glad about an election. How many people will survive till then?
You know, people look at the progressive proposals, and there's a couple out there, but I'm thinking more about Elizabeth Warren's proposal, that she thinks that households need to have $2,000 a month plus unemployment. And people look at that as entirely unrealistic, but it does a couple of things for the problems that you just noted. One is that if you're financially stable, then you can make a decision about going back to work. You can reward essential workers in a way that is comparable or exceeds that number. But part of the problem is that essential workers are going to work and then dying where they have no other choice. And as long as we don't have any clear guidelines that are established in the states about social distancing and mask wearing, we've been talking about that for 6 months, but we still have that very large group out there who believe in independent rights rather than collective responsibility. And so I'm looking at that logic and more about, do we need to provide a sustainable income for people? And also, do we all need to take our turn as essential workers? You know, think about the incredible cooperation that we could have if we pulled together, and the volunteerism that we could have if we understood, first of all, that we're relatively safe when we go out to the workplace, but also we can choose not to go out to the workplace. We all know what's driving the higher education and K through 12 is economic necessity, not necessarily the welfare of families or children. And that shouldn't be there. That shouldn't be the guideline that we're using.
Well, but one of the things, Matt, that I also think is important, and I know what Elizabeth Warren is suggesting, so the unemployment benefits plus the $2,000, you're too young probably to have this experience, but I've been on COBRA 3 times. Do you know how expensive COBRA is when you lose your health insurance because you've been unemployed and pink slipped? It's close to the $2,000. Okay, so that $2,000, that just pays for the insurance you used to have. That doesn't feed you. It doesn't pay for the car. It doesn't pay for the rent. So that $2,000 is not even, remember, this is going to unemployed people, and they maybe at one point in time did have coverage. That gets eaten up right there before you even get into all the rest of the stuff. So people don't quite understand it. And if you were trying to sort of juggle all this other stuff with the $2,000 for people that are not unemployed, guess what they have now? They have costly daycare issues. They have costly technology issues. All these things. My house is no longer a house. My house is now a workplace. It is now a daycare. It is now where I sleep. It is now where I get fed. It is now where I do my work and I try to educate my kids. Houses now have 5 functions when before they only had 2. So I think people don't even understand staying at home is not home anymore the way we historically have understood it. Home now has become a center of economics and a center of education and a center of everything else. So this isn't, you know, pissing money away. This is making rational investments in what being home actually means, Matt.
Yes, I agree. And I think, you know, this is especially important to take into consideration as we start to move forward with a broadened conception of who is an essential worker now. So I'm thinking of teachers. So prior to starting graduate school, I was a public school teacher. A lot of my friends continue to be public school teachers. They're experiencing a lot of the challenges that you're describing now. They're raising their families, they're teaching from home. All of these different worlds are being combined under one roof. And now they're facing the additional complication that many of them are going to be going back physically to the classroom. So then all of a sudden we have the introduction of this other layer where, in addition to, you know, playing an active role in caring for their own families and, you know, potentially spearheading their own child's education at home, they are bringing in an additional risk into their homes after being essentially forced back into the classroom. Not to mention, you know, all of these additional expectations that are being piled upon, you know, their large growing list of responsibilities as educators. Now, a lot of teachers, in addition to teaching in person, will be teaching online at the same time, and also will be in charge of disinfecting their classrooms at the end of every day. So all of this on top of all of the challenges that have already been mentioned regarding, you know, how the nature of the home has changed significantly over the past few months.
So there's 2 issues here, Dean. So we had Scott Braddock from Texas on, and I think it was Scott who mentioned that 40% of the teachers, I believe it was in Texas, could in fact retire. So you got this old crew that doesn't really want to deal with students because they probably are older, blah, blah, whatever. Then you've got the younger set. They have their own kids they have to teach. So they have an allegiance to their own children as educators to make sure that they get educated. I am hearing all these variations of the theme. Concord, New Hampshire, everything is going to be online and remote. I heard about another school where the teachers are going to be online, but they have to be in their classroom doing the online in their school as they teach remotely. Well, that sounds wonderful. They're in their classroom anyway, so what's the big deal? Except their kids are home. Excuse me, and where's the daycare for their kids? These guys are like from La La Land. I mean, they've obviously never been a mother. They have never had the challenge of dealing with daycare. They have no idea. They're literally asking these teachers to do things that are setting everything up to fail, including their own family. I just read about a teacher who wrote her obituary in Florida. She said, okay, you want me to go back to the classroom? Here's my obit. Just know that you filed this. I mean, this is how they feel, Dean. And people just don't understand. If the environment around us is increasing COVID-19, then our schools can't open, because our schools have to be a reflection of the safety of the community, not the failure of the community, Dean.
Yeah, it's an intractable problem. There's really no easy answer. I think everybody is kind of making decisions on the fly and reacting to whatever we're seeing on the ground at the moment. I mean, there is going to be some variation around the country based on the prevalence of infection in the community. But that said, there still are, on the one hand, as you mentioned, real risks for people based on their age, their health, the level of infection and community spread. And at the same time, for other people, there are issues of, you know, childcare and trying to keep your child on track and engaged and growing academically and educationally. It's just an incredibly difficult problem. I mean, I as I've told you before, I have several family members who are in administration and in high schools and junior highs, and listening to them talk about the competing agendas and the school board and, you know, half the parents want one thing and then the other half of the parents want the other thing. And it's all based on kind of individual situations and circumstances and economics. There's just no easy answer. I think this is going to be one or multiple big experiments this fall, and we don't really know where we're headed. I think people are going to take their best shot at what, you know, the decision makers, I think, are going to take their best guesses. And then we'll just see where we are on a week by week basis, literally.
So, okay, so we got the buckshot of opening schools. We don't know whether you're going to get your unemployment check. So let's add a third wrinkle to this. Let's talk about the post office. Oh my God. One of my own favorite topics is the United States Postal Service. So there's a couple of things that I want to talk about. The guy that's been put in by Donald Trump basically to dismantle it, which is really what his job is. His job is not to exercise a fiduciary responsibility to make sure it works like a seamless machine. Basically, his point is just to make sure. He's making a good job of dismantling it. Yeah, exactly. He's making it seem less, but it's going to seem less, not seamless. But Val, as I saw one thing that just blew my mind, and that is that they're going to charge 55 cents an envelope, not the bulk rate of 20 cents for these ballots, these mail-in ballots and these absentee ballots. That is tripling the cost of voting. Tripling the cost, okay? So you've got the cost factor going in here. You've got Donald Trump basically saying you can't trust it unless I'm doing it. And it's only in Florida because I moved to Florida, so it's got to be a good kind of way to vote. But I'm looking at the Postal Service, and it's not just the Postal Service that's in chaos because of what's happening to itself financially. It's all the misinformation swirling around, because a lot of states have never done mail-in voting. A lot of states have never done absentee balloting. This is a whole new concept. They've never signed an envelope. They've never made a request for an absentee ballot. They're not quite sure what box they check when they get the absentee ballot. This is like, if you think it's difficult to register people, this is like registration on steroids. I'm just telling you right now. So this, on top of the Postal Service, makes everyone feel like, oh my God, where's my guidance? What do I do, Val?
You know, at the heart of the problems with the post office, lying underneath it, is voter suppression. And we're seeing that. I mean, first of all, the extra charge for the ballots is going to gut the states. And we're seeing that happen in nearly every avenue, including the payroll you know, tax or unemployment or the checks that we're getting in the state is required to chip in 25%, and they know they can't afford it. But a process that you would think would be relatively simple if you wanted to get the ballots in the hands of the voters and back to be counted would be that you would make this as simple as possible. But I'll use an example of Rhode Island. Rhode Island had decided that it would allow people, the citizens, to vote by mail, but they had a rule saying that it had to be, your ballot had to be notarized by two other people. The General Assembly upheld that. And it was only through an appeals court they were able to get that thrown out. And I can't think of any other good reason than voter suppression. They use the arguments, and it happened to be on the Republican side, that it would prevent voter fraud if we had the notary. Knowing all the time that Rhode Island is ethnically diverse and that getting a notarized signature, first of all, you have to pay. It's dangerous in this time of the pandemic.
It's a poll tax.
Yeah. And it took a court, an appeals court, to overturn this for something that should be simple. If we were all going into this in the individual states saying, how can we make this as easy as possible? We have several models out there. We could look at Washington State. They've been voting for quite some time and very effectively with very little fraud. Why can't we use that as a national model? The answer is voter suppression.
So the other thing is, Matt, so we have been talking about this on this show for a long time. I love ProPublica because they have this segment called Election Land. Go to ProPublica, everyone. If you want to pull your hair out, Election Land will make sure that you're bald by the time you finish reading it. But one of the things that we were talking about is that we are worried about the Postal Service. We know that it's being intentionally gutted. So the idea is what a lot of these states do is they have an alternative to the post office. It's called the Dropbox, okay? And it's either in the clerk's office or it's right next to the post box, and it kind of looks like a postal box, except it says voting on it, and you drop your little mail thing in there and they pick it up every day. Well, it turns out that they're now talking about, oh, you can't trust the Dropbox because they're going to stuff them. And I'm like, they're going to what? They're going to stuff them. And I'm thinking, what's the difference between stuffing a Dropbox and stuffing a post box? I'm just trying to figure out what's the difference. It's like, you know, this is kind of like, what's the difference between absentee balloting and vote by mail? What's the difference between a Dropbox and a mailbox? And now the argument is because it's ripe for stuffing. So I'm thinking they're coming up with these ideas. And I mean, I want to laugh, but it's terrifying because people are like, what does that mean? And I'm like, I don't know. What does that mean, Matt?
So I'm by no means an expert of the post office, nor, you know, am I one to distinguish between the post box and the drop boxes. But this issue of the post office is, you know, something that is truly keeping me up at night. In addition to all of the institutional constraints that, you know, you and Val have already addressed, there is also this question of, you know, the ideological divides of those who are claiming that they're going to vote by mail versus those who are claiming that they're not. I mean, you see prominent progressive Democratic politicians really pushing vote by mail where, you know, now that this has become a partisan issue, Republicans are saying otherwise. So I think it's genuinely concerning that you have the entire foundation of vote by mail becoming polarized to the point where we might have, you know, Democrats overly relying on this institution that, as you pointed out, could be undermined. And there's also this question too about the general anxiety that's going to come on election day when you have a lot of these states for the first time are essentially going to be running multiple different elections. They're going to have then in-person voting, they're going to have vote by mail voting, and it's likely going to take the results much longer than they typically do. And I think that that's an important conversation to have in these months leading up to the election, just as a way to assuage the fear that the results are somehow going to be compromised by virtue of the fact that they're taking so long to tabulate.
Well, so Dean, so there's a couple things I want to talk about here. And that is, again, I'm going to go back to my friend who is overseeing the vote in her town. And she said, this is like the worst of all options. I'm going to need lots of people to help me with the absentee ballots. Never before will we have such an onslaught of absentee ballots. So they're going to have to open them and tabulate them and make sure that they're accurate, make sure they were signed. I mean, it's not just opening something. You have to make sure, did they sign it properly, all that kind of stuff. In addition to which, I'm going to need volunteers to man the election. So I need a double amount at a time when COVID-19 may be raging. The people that normally man and volunteer are my little blue-haired ladies, you know, all with diabetes and heart conditions. So I don't really want them to show up, even if they're masked and shielded, because I'm worried about their health. And then I got a bunch of lunatics who I already said that if you're going to come in and vote, you must be masked. Well, they've already told me they are not, that this is going to, that you're suppressing their vote because they're not going to wear a mask. So she now has to have a place outside the voting so she can have the unmasked outside in the snow, maybe voting outside, because she's not going to allow them in to vote inside because they're not wearing a mask, which will compromise the health of her volunteers. I mean, she said, Arnie, this is the worst headache because everything is happening simultaneously. When I have fewer people to support me, I have less money to make it happen. And the level of complication, because we've never had this onslaught of absentee balloting, and we're now hearing that the absentee ballot in New Hampshire actually doesn't match the application for the absentee ballot. So we've got conflicts between what you sign to put your envelope in to send in your absentee ballot and what you do when you request the absentee ballot. So now people are like, I don't want to sign this. What you're asking me to sign isn't what I asked for. So it's like, And I'm just trying to figure out, what guidance do I give people? Should they physically just show up, which is what Republicans are saying? I'm almost ready to get on that bandwagon.
Yeah, you know, there's no, I'm not full of a lot of easy answers today. This is just another incredibly complicated set of
challenges.
That's
the point, Dean. That's the point.
What's amazing is we know what the challenges are, and it's still not clear to me that we're going to be able to meet them, given the amount of time we have, given the constraints on resources, both financial, not only financial support from the federal government, but just as you said, on the ground, literally finding people who are able to man the polls. I'm in the same situation. I vote every time I vote, the same lovely people have been signing me in for like 25 years. They're all, I think, in their 80s at this point. I love seeing them every time. They know me on site, but my guess is they're not going to be there this time. So the reality is we are shifting towards a mail-driven election, and all the energy has to be focused on that reality, whether it involves changing when you start counting ballots, or the how you shift your resources, fewer in-person polling places, more people working in the back office counting ballots. And it, you know, as we know, the part of the problem is that it varies from state to state. And then you superimpose on top of this poll watchers, lawyers for both parties. It's just going to be a very difficult situation. One of my biggest concerns is just people's expectations. We're used to having, with the exception of 2000, we're used to having races called at about 10 o'clock so we can all, you know, go to bed.
So,
and that's just not going to happen.
The Spanish word, mañana. It's like, we're going to have to learn. I mean, this is going to be, there was one of the slow skis on TV. What are they say, for the internet connection? There's the slow skis. Well, I'm going to have to sort of teach people that when it comes to this election, we're all going to have to be slow skis, because we're not going to get the instant gratification that we expect here. But before we end this conversation on Rethink the Week, Val, I got to touch on this. And that is, they want to end the census a month early. On top of all this garbage, they want to end the census a month early, which means there's going to be an undercount of Black voters, Hispanic voters, the undocumented. You know this. I cannot figure out for the life of me why places like California, Florida, Texas, Louisiana, they're not apoplectic, because this isn't an undercount. This is a financial shaft. This is unbelievable. And you would think, I don't care whether you're a Republican governor or a Democratic governor, how do you survive if there's an undercount in your state? Because what does it mean for congressional representation? And what does it mean for the bucks? It means the bucks don't show up, Belle.
really think that this is a part of a puzzle that is a plan. And we think about Donald Trump, there usually is a method behind his madness. So we're looking at the idea that voting is going to take multiple days. Donald Trump said the longer that it's going to take to count votes, the more fraudulent it will be. They're closing the census a month early. And that is how we redraw congressional districts. And without properly counting, the people who are most vulnerable not to be counted in a census, who happen to be Democrats, or are vulnerable and need to be protected. And by shutting off the census, we know exactly what's happening. The white suburban voters have filled out their census forms. That's not a problem, and they are more likely to be Republican. And so shutting this down early, there's no logic to it whatsoever. We should extend it. And I was surprised when I read that, because I thought we should extend it for a longer period of time, given the pandemic.
Well, so let me just say something, Matt, because you know what? She mentions that, you know, white suburban women or what, you know, that maybe Republicans have filled theirs out, but Democrats. Here's the kicker. When you don't get the check from the feds because they miscounted you, you will feel it whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. When you don't get the congressional representation, you will feel it whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. So it's not just, it doesn't hurt African Americans. It doesn't hurt undocumented. It hurts the frickin' state. That's who gets hurt. You know, it's an equal opportunity shafter. So if I were a wealthy, affluent GOP, I don't want to spend more in taxes because you didn't include thousands and thousands of people that live in my state because you ended the census early and I'm going to have to pay for that. Why isn't anyone doing the math for those people, Matt?
Yeah, so I think this ultimately comes down to is a lot of times, you know, when people are formulating their opinions regarding certain policies, there's this sense that a tagline or maybe your predispositions towards one party over another is ultimately what's guiding your opinion. But to your point, ultimately, and we saw this with the Affordable Care Act as well, a lot of times, you know, when these policies do start to impact people at the state level, that's when you start to see individuals realizing that it's affecting their own daily lives and you start to see a shift in opinion. But you're absolutely right. This is something that individuals ideally would be looking into now in order to avoid this impending crisis.
So I need to let the three of you go and Ken Barnes, my producer, Val Endres, Rhode Island College's political communication professor, Matt Nelson, a new PhD at Northwestern, Dean Spilios from Southern New Hampshire University. I'm just telling you right now, what Joe Biden should do is he should just keep doing the math. Do the math on what happens with unemployment. Do the math when it comes on the Social Security and FICA. Do the math with the census, because the math of the census isn't about an undercount of Hispanics or Blacks. It's about less money. Less money. Go to their wallets, and that will make a difference in November. And on that, let me say au revoir. All right, everyone, stick around. We'll talk to you on Tuesday, Joe.